It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Today, we explore what it means to be Southern and Latino. But first, we talked about how political differences can become irreconcilable differences.
We do marry our opposites in terms of values and so on. And when something like this comes up, which is so basic, so primal to our values in terms of the difference in political stance, it cannot be ignored anymore. So all these underlying conflicts that have been glossed over previously are now up front.
Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Patricia Carter from Athens, Georgia. I come from a huge family, and what I would say is the singular difference in my friends and family is that it's people who watch Fox and people who don't. Fox issues have made people not only one-sided, but even mean.
This is Vince from East Cobb. My father and one of my uncles are very, very vehement Trump supporters, while my other uncle and his partner supported Hillary Clinton. And we respect each other, and I think that if maybe we learn to look at the person and not their beliefs, this division in the country would slowly begin to heal.
We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the program. Today, Atlanta is the Hollywood of the South, home to multi-billion dollar businesses, and boasts the busiest airport in the world. It's worked hard to gain its place in America's top 10. Scoring the Centennial Olympics in 1996 helped. The story of the Games is also key to understanding the Latino boom in Atlanta, and in the South more broadly. Zakiya Gibbons spent some time in the South reporting for the public radio show Latino USA.
The story of the 1996 Olympics is actually key to understanding the Latino boom in Atlanta and in the South at large. Before we get into that, though, let's go back to when Atlanta was still in the corner of the lunchroom, yearning to join the popular kids.
Even before the Olympic period, when Ambassador Young was the mayor, he used to talk about Atlanta as the next international city. And this was in a time when Atlanta had a population of under 400,000 people.
That's Sam Zamarripa, former state senator of Georgia. He's also the first Latino to serve in the Georgia State Senate. Back in the 80s, he was working as an aide to the then mayor of Atlanta, Andrew Young.
Well, I'd always wanted to go to the Olympics since I was 4 years old.
That's him speaking to Georgia Public Broadcasting last year. Everyone at the mayor's office thought the idea was super far-fetched and not even worth entertaining. But Young became hooked on Atlanta becoming the home to the Centennial Olympic Games.
I grew up in New Orleans, and the Nazi party was on the corner of my house. And the way my father explained white supremacy and Nazism to me was to take me to the Movietone News to see Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics.
Opening comes the most amazing performance by America's black streak Jesse Owens in the 100 meters. The world's most superb runner makes the others look as if they're walking.
So I was 4 years old then. And he said, you see, you don't get angry and upset with white supremacists. It's a sickness. You find a way to rise above the sickness. And he used Jesse Owens as an example because when Jesse won the first race, Hitler got up and walked out of the stadium and took all of his stormtroopers with him.
To Owens, star of the squad, goes the laurel of a champion.
I share the Olympic dream that we can stop fighting and compete on the athletic field. If we can do that for 17 days every 4 years, we ought to be able to learn to do it every year. And maybe we can learn to live together as brothers and sisters rather than perish together as fools.
Atlanta was a city still licking its wounds from fraught race relations. And the 1996 Olympics was a chance for a clean slate. Mayor Andrew Young and other high-ups in Atlanta wanted to revamp its reputation and show the world how far they've come since the civil rights movement of the 60s. So Mayor Young, rather than perishing together as fools, wanted to bring Atlanta and the world together through the Olympics. Mayor Young had the challenge of winning over the International Olympic Committee and convincing them to choose Atlanta to host the 1996 Olympic Games. And like at a fancy networking party with the bigwigs, it's all about wooing and schmoozing and selling yourself. And Atlanta's big selling point?
It was the first Olympic city that was able to use the history of civil rights.
Here's Sam Zamarripa again, talking about Mayor Young's pitch.
A lot of his intellectual energy focused on the unique attributes of the civil rights legacy in Atlanta. I think Andrew Young's vision was that Atlanta could share that vision on a world stage. And that was a compelling story.
But it wouldn't be just any Olympics. This was the Centennial Olympics, the 100th anniversary of the very first Olympics. And Atlanta, home to less than 500,000 people at the time and known to even less, wanted to host the biggest Olympic Games yet. But despite the David and Goliath situation, Mayor Young put Atlanta on the ballot up against Athens, Greece, the birthplace of the Olympics, and other cities with more clout. Fast forward several weeks, and people around the world were gathering to see which city won the Olympic bid.
The International Olympic Committee has awarded the 1996 Olympic Games to the city of Atlanta.
There were so many parties in the streets and hugging and kissing. It was like winning the global lottery and not even knowing that you had a ticket in the basket. It was just phenomenal.
As soon as all the confetti was swept up, Atlanta went to work. The tiny city had to build an arena, housing, and fields worthy of the world's best athletes. And everyone was watching.
They were building multiple stadiums, multiple sites. There was a time frame associated with it.
Excitement shifted to nervousness as the deadline drew nearer and the buildings were still only partially built. Washington Post journalist William Booth published an article on April 20th, 1996, describing the scene. The hospitable but anxious first city of the South is like a frazzled hostess scrambling to set the table minutes before the Sunday company arrives. In this case, 2 million or so guests. So you get the picture. Atlanta needed help. And while the local construction team was working hard, it wasn't enough, and they needed more hands. So it was time to find more construction workers. Teodoro Mouse was the Mexican consul in Atlanta at the time. He says an official with the Immigration and Naturalization Service called him to say they weren't going to do much enforcement until the end of the Olympics. Mouse says he was then asked to sort of spread the word in the Mexican community that the federal government was willing to look the other way while immigrants, many of them undocumented, gave the city a helping hand. Sam Zamarripa, the former Georgia state senator we've been hearing from, doesn't put it past INS, especially during the 90s. Back then, there was no giant border wall or continuous patrolling of the border.
I absolutely also knew the director of the INS during that time period. And it doesn't surprise me that the INS voluntarily elected to reduce any kind of enforcement in that era because too much was at stake.
We do have to mention that there is no way to prove that officials actively suspended immigration enforcement. INS doesn't exist anymore. The agency dissolved when ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was formed. ICE officials told me they, quote, can't confirm that any such suspension took place surrounding the Atlanta Olympics in 1996, end quote. But whatever happened, word spread that there were construction jobs available and that crossing the border was easier than ever. Zamarripa says soon enough, a bus system popped up and brought workers from border states and across the border to Atlanta.
Make no mistake, their buses were running constantly. I was up there in some mornings at 7 a.m. in the morning, sometimes two and three buses pulling into this little corner on Beaufort Highway and unloading hundreds of workers.
Soon enough, Atlanta, known for being largely black and white, was becoming browner and browner.
And overnight, there was a taco shop on every corner.
As more and more buses brought in workers, the faster the sites got built.
And this work, we began at 7 in the morning and it went on to 7 and 8 o'clock at night every day for years. And the streets were teeming with Latino workers.
The frenzied host finally got the table set. Atlanta made its construction deadline.
There is no way, in my opinion, that the 1996 game schedule could have been met without having the contribution of the Latino workforce.
And as the 1996 Olympics came and went, the Latino workforce stayed behind.
It would only be post-Olympics that the response would take such a negative turn.
Now that the dust had cleared, the Atlanta residents looked around and noticed that demographics had changed. Sam Zamarripa, who at this point post-Olympics had just become Georgia's first Latino state senator, recalled a conversation he had with Governor Sonny Perdue, who is now the Secretary of Agriculture for the Trump administration.
He said, I want to tell you something. People are telling me that they're beginning to see these Mexican workers in Walmart. And I thought he was going to say something else. And I looked at him and I realized that what he was saying was that the workforce was beginning to show up in the fabric of their communities and they didn't like it. So it was okay for this workforce to come in and to do the work, to build the buildings, to clean hotel rooms, but it wasn't okay for them to show up at Walmart. And I did not take that as the governor telling me that was his opinion, but I took that the governor was telling me what people really thought. And I do think that there is something about the South. There is this ideal that the South has a unique history that must be preserved. And sometimes that notion of preservation takes the form of resisting any kind of change.
That unique history is the same history that Mayor Young was trying to move past, racial segregation and oppression. As Young said, it was Atlanta's racial harmony that won them the opportunity to host one of the biggest Olympic Games of all time. But it was a new racial group that came in and helped Atlanta come out on top. Atlanta took the stage to show its progress, to show the rest of the world different races and nationalities coming together on the field. Once the stadiums emptied, the Latino immigrants that came to help stayed, but the feeling of racial harmony didn't.
If you want to think about one of the great legacies of the Olympic Games, it is the fact that the Mexican community came here and stayed, because they have enriched Atlanta in so many ways and will continue to do so. And so I do think that that is one of the legacies that over time will be larger and larger and larger and is observable.
Now, two decades after the Centennial Olympic Games, Atlanta seems to have achieved its goal. It has become a well-known, well-respected international city, home to celebrities, billion-dollar companies, and it literally connects people from all over the world with the world's busiest airport. But Atlanta wouldn't be where it is now. It wouldn't be the Hollywood of the South if it first hadn't been the home to the biggest Olympic Games in history. And it wouldn't have pulled it off without the help of Latinos that sprinted into action and carried the torch to the finish line. For GPP News, I'm Zakiya Gibbons.
Zakiya Gibbons is a producer for the public radio show Latino USA. This week, the program explores Latino population growth in the South. Just ahead, I'll talk with Latino USA host and executive producer Maria Hinojosa about what it means to be Southern and Latino today. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. The South has seen its Hispanic population increase 43% between 2007 and 2014. That's according to the Pew Research Center. Journalist Maria Hinojosa recently visited Georgia to see what it's like to be Latino and Southern. She's president and founder of the Futuro Media Group and host and executive producer of NPR's Latino USA. Her latest show features some stories from the Peach State, from Georgia. Maria, my friend, good to speak to you again. How are you?
It's good to be back on the air with you, Tony.
Yay.
And hello, Georgia.
What does it mean? Buried in that lead is, I guess, my first question. What is it like to be Latino and Southern?
So this is a conversation that really is about the entire country understanding that our South is becoming more complicated and complex. So Latino Southerners, I would probably say, are a lot like any Southerner in the sense that, you know, and it's hard for me as a I laugh when I say this as a quote-unquote northerner, you know, because I'm like, what? What's that exactly? But, you know, there's a love of the pace of life, of the feeling of being in the South, of that friendliness. By the way, Tony, I got to tell you, when I first went to Atlanta, before I worked for CNN, and somebody said to me, "Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am." I was offended. I was just like, why are you calling me a ma'am? Tony, I have learned from my fellow Americans who live in the South, and that includes people with papers and without papers, in my view. Mm-hmm. And I now use yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, no, sir, to everyone in my life, to the man who is taking my luggage, to the person who's delivering the Chinese food, to, you know, anyone. It's yes, sir, and no, ma'am. And I learned that from the South in general. So Latino Southerners are like any other Southerner. On the other hand, there is something very particular right now if you are a Latino Southerner in a state like Georgia or in a state like Alabama, right? It is not the same as being white or black. It is, sadly, specifically, because you have laws that are targeting this population, this is a population that, as much as it is just like everybody else in the South, they are also being targeted today and every single day. And that is something that the rest of the South that is not living under that experience, y'all need to understand that too.
Yeah. You took us a step forward. I'm going to take us a step back for just a moment here. And you've been coming to Atlanta, I've heard you speak about this since the 90s, right? And before your program took the part one of the Southern Road Trip, I know there's more to come, how much did you even know about the rapid growth of the Mexican population here in Georgia in the build-up right to the 96 Olympics? I heard this on your program, and frankly, I hadn't heard that story before your program.
Yay. I'm so happy.
That's
to
the
hear
point.
That.
Right.
We taught Tony Harris
you
something.
You absolutely did.
And if we're teaching Tony Harris something, we know we're teaching a lot of other people. I had been going to Atlanta since before the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And the first time that we went, I think it was 1994. It was the Unity Convention. And we actually sent out one of our budding journalists to actually ask the question of Atlantans, where is the barrio? And we have the tape of people saying, barrio? What's a bar? What? Bar what? And of course, you know, then full circle to where we are now. But I did not know the absolute fascination of the Latino-Latina role in the Olympics.
Oh,
and
amazing.
So I'm very pleased. But I have to say, Tony, in reporting out this story, I was like, wow, you know, I'm proudly have been going to the South and reporting about the South since the early 1990s. So I have, in fact, watched it transform. And I'm fascinated every time I go back.
Yeah.
And seriously, with all due respect to my taco brothers and sisters in Chicago, where I grew up, because, I was born in Mexico, raised in Chicago, have the best Mexican food there. Nope. Best tacos are now in Atlanta. Boom. Drop the mic. It's true.
Plaza Fiesta. That's what you're talking about. That's where you had this amazing taco. So describe Plaza Fiesta for listeners who don't know.
So Plaza Fiesta, I guess if you look at it from not being inside of it, it looks totally nondescript. There's nothing really special that calls out and says, oh, my God, you've got to come in here. So it's just a basic, you know, one floor large mall, strip mall-ish. But when you go inside, you literally open the doors. It's as if I'm walking into a similar strip mall in Mexico, in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in Colombia even. So it's kind of like you all have this experience while, you know, there's an attempt to build a wall. What you guys have is actually you have no wall between you and the Latino population that are your brothers and sisters in your Atlanta metropolitan area. And by going there and seeing it, you will see that we are very Latino Mexican. We have our ways, you know, the quinceañera dresses, You know, the kind of, there's a lot of party stuff that we have. There's a lot of celebration of life, you know, yeah. because this is a beautiful social skill that we are bringing to the American and Southern conversation is just our joie de vivre. Our, yeah. And I can't believe I just said that in French,
and
but
you
okay.
did it really well.
You know, that you go to Plaza Fiesta and you're going to feel that. You're going to see all the little kids happy as can be yeah. without a little instrument like a phone in their hands.
Yeah.
You're going to see people talking across generations, sharing amazing food. And you're going to get that by going to like a strip mall that doesn't look like a whole heck of a lot
yeah.
from the outside.
And this is in
and
Chamblee.
You've got that
yeah.
to your, yes, Chamblee,
yeah.
accessible to anyone
yeah.
in your on your fingertips.
You spoke to, while you were there, you spoke to Carlos Chavez. He's a restaurant owner there. And Carlos, a bit of his backstory, he came to the U.S. from Mexico City. And he's called, I guess he's called Atlanta home for the last 30, 35 years. I want to play a bit of sound from your interview with him. He says Atlanta still has, and we know this to be true, it still has challenges when it comes to racial harmony. Here's his view of it.
Atlanta is still very divided. South side, Afro-Americans, North side, more white Americans. So we're in the middle. We are like fighting between both of them, and we blend it in. Some people like us, some people don't. So it all depends on what day they get up on the right side of the bed, you know.
Maria, describe that middleness, that betweenness, certainly not words, but you know what I'm getting at here.
Well, it's hard for me to describe it because I'm not a Latina Southerner.
Yeah.
But I think, frankly, it's also not just a dynamic of the American South. Sadly, Tony, what we are living in our country right now is It's kind of like a pointing out of the Latino-Latina population, the immigrant population, and saying, you are a problem.
Right.
You are a problem. We need a wall. You're a problem in our country. You have gangs. This is an administration that has been very frontal in terms of its critique about this particular part of the U.S. population.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all, frankly, me included, even though, you know, I'm a journalist
yeah,
of stature,
sure.
blah, blah. We're all like, wait, what's going on here?
So wait a minute, Maria, let me stop you there. Because you tee up my next question so perfectly, and I don't want you to give a piece of the answer there and a piece of the answer here. I just want to hear you on this point clearly. Pretty simple question. What does President Trump represent to you, you personally, and the people whose stories you tell so beautifully?
You know, Tony, you and I are journalists. We are professionals. We've known each other for a very long time, and we have interacted mostly as professionals. And so we have respect for each other because of our profession. And so I have to tell you that it is quite strange. It is not normal for me as an American citizen to feel like this particular administration and this particular president has very specifically spoken about who I am, the things that I represent. As being a Mexican, an immigrant, a woman, and a journalist. So, I am a professional. So I continue, and by the way, Donald Trump supporters continue to speak to me and give us interviews because they know that that is what I do in my profession.
Right.
But very personally, it is a very challenging time for an American journalist, as you being an
sure.
African-American man from the South also. So I say that because it's important for us to have this dialogue because it is a challenging question for all of us. But that, whatever I feel or how I feel, it's still, for me, the bigger issue is what is happening to our country and how are we talking about the fact that Latinos and Latinas have been here since the beginning, right? Because Mexican territory went up
yeah,
to Canada.
Yeah. Right.
So we have the Mexicanos have been here since the quote-unquote beginning, no matter what Steve Bannon has to say about that. So, and we're not going anywhere. There's no place for us to go back to. So it's about how Southerners and Latinos who are from the South are having this conversation internally, really.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Maria Hinojosa. She is the president and founder of the Futuro Media Group and host and executive producer of NPR's Latino USA. So the president sends out the attorney general to announce that the president is ending the DACA program, which shields the so-called dreamers from deportation.
To have a lawful system of immigration that serves the national interest, we cannot admit everyone who would like to come here. It's just that simple. That would be an open borders policy, and the American people have rightly rejected that.
How does your media group decide to handle this breaking news and cover this story?
Well, you know, actually, Tony, we do an hour-long show that is based on themes.
Yeah.
So we're not always responsive to the news. That's not where we're not.
You
CNN.
Were this time, though.
But we were this time, yeah, because we broke format. We did a podcast-only version of our reporting about the response to DACA. The phone was blowing up when we made a request for people who were part of DACA to get in touch with us and tell us their side of the story. I was blowing up my phone because I was actually trying to talk to as many Latino and Latina Donald Trump supporters about their response to this. So that's what I was doing. And what my staff did and why I love them so much, because, you know, I created my own company.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nonprofit media company. It's based in Harlem. We produce Latino USA. And
they,
our newsroom, I actually wrote a little email to the staff and I said, our newsroom felt just like the CNN newsroom.
Yeah.
The kind of buzz, the kind of energy. And they turned it around in 2 days, by the way, because I don't remember where I was traveling to. I was on my way, actually, to receive an award at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists.
Mm-hmm.
So they turned it around and we brought in the human side,
yes,
but we also gave the context, and all of the response that we got in the social media love was, thank you for the context, thank you for the context, thank you for the context, because there is a lot of information out there that is taking this out of context. And certainly Jefferson Beauregard Sessions is taking it out of context and giving misinformation about what DACA is
right,
himself. And he's speaking for the American government.
And as I sort of bring it back to where we started here, we talk about this growth in Hispanic population, particularly in the South, and the Pew number is 43%. What's the opportunity there, politically, economically? What's the opportunity in that tremendous growth statistic?
My gosh, the first thing that came to mind is, well, what's the political opportunity? And it's kind of like, I think that Georgia needs to realize, all of you need to wrap your heads around the fact that you are going to see more and more and more and more and more Latino and Latina and immigrant candidates from your state at every level, from the school board to the city council to mayors to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is going to happen. That is a reality. And sadly, I think for the Republican Party, probably many of these will run as Democrats. I say that sadly in the sense that it really should be that we're having both parties infused, or as multiple parties infused. But, you know, the Republicans are doing things that may cost them many, many, many elections in the future, because the demographics are there. And this demographics of Georgia are there, and that is going to begin to impact. So that's like one opportunity, is to like get to know the people who are going to be
right,
running for office and see them as your fellow Southerners.
And winning elections.
Right, and winning elections.
Yeah.
They are absolutely going to start winning elections.
Yeah.
It may not happen, you know, in 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, but it's going to happen. And the other opportunity, I think, is this is such an extraordinary moment for the South. I mean, it is a time in which all of you, can help really create and show the complexity of what's happening in the South. It is no longer black and white. It is not only Latino, but it is Asian as well, and Caribbean, and African. So you all, who the entire country sees you as just this black-white dynamic, you all have the opportunity to actually invigorate like one of the most amazing transformations of the American kind of cultural and demographic narrative, and it's in your hands. And that to me is just incredibly exciting. And I'm telling you, the best tacos in all of the United States in Atlanta, what happened? Own it. Enjoy it. There's nothing to fear.
That's Maria Hinojosa. She is the president and founder of the Futuro Media Group and the host and executive producer of NPR's Latino USA. This week's Latino USA features stories of Latinos in Georgia and in other parts of the South. A link to that program can be found at gpbnews.org. Maria, great to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tony. Good to talk to you, too.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school.
Just ahead, how Atlanta is keeping Tupac Shakur's legacy alive. This is On Second Thought.
Over the years, we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blame mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hell, hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama cast me, put a whoop into my back.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Metro Atlanta's population just keeps growing to the tune of 90,000 plus last year. That puts Atlanta in fourth place nationally. Is Atlanta running out of room? We'd like to hear from you. Has Atlanta's population growth made you rethink whether you'd stay or even move there? Here's our number, 404-500-9457. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook, and then be sure to tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. A play based on hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur's life is showing now at the Atlanta True Colors Theater Company. The musical, Holla If You Hear Me, is based on Shakur's music and lyrics. Kenny Leon is the show's director, as he was in the Broadway version. Tupac's mother, Afeni Shakur, donated a collection of her son's works to the Atlanta University Center Woodruff Library. The archives include handwritten manuscripts, diary entries, song lyrics, and other personal items. I talked about the collection with hip-hop scholar Nsenga Burton. Nsenga, good to see you. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you, too.
I have had the most wonderful conversations about Tupac, and I've got to admit this right off the top. I was Biggie. I was more Biggie than Tupac, right?
Yes.
Even though I'm a Baltimore kid, right? And Tupac spent time, you too?
10 years.
I
lived in Baltimore, yes.
Okay, so when you think about Tupac Shakur, what comes to mind?
It's funny that you say Baltimore because that's actually the first thing I think about because he really is iconic there for a lot of different reasons than he's iconic for the rest of the country and the world, I would argue. Tupac is remembered in Baltimore as being very much of a layered individual. You know, he went to the very prestigious and illustrious Baltimore School of Performing Arts, right? And so everybody knows that that's one of the toughest art schools to get into on the East Coast and probably in the country. And they're very selective. And so the fact that he actually went there, he was admitted there, and that he had to engage in there, not only creative curriculum, but also their academic curriculum.
Right.
People have a different kind of idea or way of seeing and thinking about Tupac in that from that perspective. But I think that his persona, you know, when he came out of prison, Clinton Correctional Facility, the persona that he adopted, because I never really believed that.
A persona that he adopted?
Yeah, I never believed that was Tupac. I mean, I just did not, based on all of the things I had known about him. I only met him once. I didn't have a real conversation with him. I was just in the same space with him.
So because this is a central question, the mystery of Tupac.
Well,
he really was.
Well, and that's what this movie offers, right? And this is what this collection offers, right? So you have this movie, which is Benny Boom and, you know, a bunch of other folks, their perspectives of who Tupac is. Then you have the late, great Afeni Shakur, who's the mother of Tupac, also an intellectual, political activist and what have you, and her perspective of who her son is,
right?
The real Tupac. And so she has taken the time or took the time to, like, you know, carefully and methodically go through his materials for 2 years in order to figure out how and what they want people to know about Tupac. Like, who is Tupac? And so out of this comes these letters.
But is it their vision of who Tupac was, or is it can we think of it as the real version of two? How are we to think about the materials?
Well, I think that because Fannie Shakur is his mother, and I'm a mother, right? So I feel like no one can tell me about my daughter other than me, right?
Good, bad, and otherwise.
Good, bad, and otherwise. Like, so all the stuff you're going to tell me about her, she's a baby, she's 19 months, but all the stuff you're going to tell me about her, even in daycare, I already know.
Yes.
No, but having said that, Fannie Shakur, you know, the mother-son bond is an important one. A lot of times people focus on the father-son bond, the mother-daughter bond. But the mother-son bond, especially in the Black community, when many of our households are led by Black women, is a very important bond that people share. And so in this particular collection, the fact that she actually took the time to go through his materials and include, you know, treatments for music videos. She has the notebooks that he wrote All Eyes on Me and Tupacalypse Now in. She included a card, you know, her last card to him on his 25th birthday, that she wrote to him that has, like, a, you know, just the sweetest note in it. So, you know, she, I think, you know, there are different versions of Tupac. There are many layers to his lives. But if you want to see, you know, who he was as a son, if you want to see who he was as an artist, if you want to see who he was as an icon and as a leader in the community, then you want to see this collection.
So, and Zenga, I want to play a clip from the movie called All Eyes on Me. And and it touches on some of the complications in that relationship.
Yeah.
Let's roll the clip and let's talk about it.
Okay.
Like all Black leaders, you have a bullseye on your back. And today it just got bigger.
But I ain't no Black leader. Not yet.
And how you not a Black leader? The vice president was just talking about you on the TV. Baby, you have to understand. With the Panthers, it wasn't that we had guns or Black leather. It was because of our message. We were transforming minds.
And look, Fannie was a member of the Panthers. You know, she and 21 other members of the Panthers stood trial in New York, accused of what we would call today domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Did she see her son as a Black leader? And did Tupac ever come to see himself as a Black leader?
Yeah, I think the film actually does a great job of capturing that. And it does do a great job of how she saw him relative to how he saw himself. I think it took time for him to realize that that was his role, his kind of his inherited identity, right? So kids develop identities in line with their parents and separate from their parents, right? So when you're trying to figure out who you are and where you want to be in the world, it may be completely in line with your parents and it may be completely oppositional to what your parents want you to be. And so, yeah, she absolutely thought that it was every Black man and woman's responsibility to be some type of leader in the community because our community was in such a state, particularly at the time period, if you're talking about the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you know, you're going from post-industrial economics in most of the major cities. You're having uprisings. You know, this is post-assassination of King.
Yeah.
This is, you know, the post-industrial complex. You know, jobs are starting to go overseas. You've got Reaganomics coming in. So all of this, and then the introduction of crack to African-American communities. And so you have all of these things happening that are really destroying our community. And so her idea was that we should all be leaders, right? This is the Black Panther moniker.
Yeah.
Taking responsibility for yourself, self-identity, self-determination. And she thought Tupac should do that. And as a man, and as brilliant as he was, he should be using his talents in that way.
Yeah. I want to play another clip from the movie. There's a bunch of sound that I want to get to as we talk about the life of Tupac Shakur. This is another clip for the movie.
The man I knew wanted to use his voice to educate, to bring people together.
If he coming at me, he gonna get dealt with.
So can nobody tell you nothing, huh? Huh?
Not about this.
If he's coming at me, he's gonna get dealt with. And that brings to mind the illusions of the phraseology, thug life.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about Tupac's embrace of thug life. It was tattooed on his belly.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean for him?
Well, it was actually an acronym, and I think that he was trying to be subversive in using it, right? But what happened is that people weren't ready for that subversion, right? Part of how subversiveness works, or part of the way that being subversive works, is people have to be kind of in on the information that you are kind of deconstructing.
Yeah.
Right. And so because he's part of rap, because he's now on death row, people are immediately going to, oh, he's embracing being a thug, a criminal, a hoodlum, a gangster, when really what he was doing was kind of highlighting the complexities again, right? Of, you know, our identities. You know, there he is the intellectual. He does quote Shakespeare. He does do ballet. But he also, you know, does rap. He does hip hop. And it's not separate necessarily. It all kind of lives together.
What do you criticize in Tupac's life?
I think Tupac, there's room for criticism with Tupac, of course. In his,
oh, there's plenty of room right, for criticism
in,
with Tupac.
In his misogynistic lyrics, the way that he appeared to treat women. I think there's room for criticism in that
he spent time in prison for sexual abuse.
That he spent time in prison for sexual abuse. I think there's lots of room for critique about Tupac in a myriad of ways. You know, how he spent his money. And he was doing things to help the community kind of quietly. And it's kind of the way that Prince did, right? He was doing things that we didn't know about. So what we saw was all of this kind of, you know, glamorization of excess. You know, we saw a lot of that. So I think that there's room for criticism in terms of how he did use that platform. And the fact that he did have that intellectual piece, he had the activist piece. And even though it was part of, it's really part of his identity, the part that was most exposed was the kind of nefarious part.
Yeah.
And I think that he had more control over that. Like, he was smarter than that.
Yeah, I want to play a clip. This is from Tupac. We should hear his own voice.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is from an interview with BET.
I trip off because it happens out of nothing. It just goes, you know, everybody just be screaming and acting. And I just trip. I get uncomfortable. And it's like similar to a deer being caught in the headlights. I just freeze, you know, and I don't know what to do. I don't know if I should be what they want me to be or if I should make them hate me so they can stop, you know, like say something mean so they can just stop. But I'm just like caught in the middle of it because, I mean, no one can do that. Police can't do that. They can't stand in front of all those people and control them with a gun and mace and all that. So me with just words, it's like a battle to find the right words to say at the right time.
So what does that clip say to you? It sounds like a bit of the complication and the conflict in his own life and in his own mind about how to present himself and the meaning of his message.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's very aware of the power of words. You can tell that in this clip. And he's very aware of how words can be used against you when the intention is different. Right. Yeah. So, you know, the basic communication model is not what you say or how you say it, it's how it's received. Right. That's just basic communication. And so I don't think he really had an academic knowledge of that, but he was experiencing that real world. Right. So with Thug Life, again, you know, most people are thinking, oh, he's glamorizing being a thug. But if you actually talk to him and sit down and have a conversation with him about it, you find out that he's actually deconstructing what it means and trying to throw light or shed light on the complexities that live within us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
what's the relevance today? I'm thinking about people all over the state of Georgia who are listening to us right now and maybe asking themselves, what's the relevance of a Tupac? Why are we talking about, you know, a guy who claimed thug life, right? What's the relevance of Tupac in his life and his message today, you think?
Well, he's going to be relevant forever because Tupac really, at a young age, people forget that he died at 25.
Yes.
So he had all of these accomplishments before he was the age of 25, right? But he's relevant because he speaks to what is happening to people in the streets. You know, that hasn't changed. The conditions, and we're seeing that, you know. And so I think Tupac is relevant in terms of his lyrics, some of the things that he talked about, whether it was social justice, police brutality, people taking control of themselves and determining where they want to be and who they want to be and how they want to get there, not being a slave to dominant ideologies about race or, I will add now, gender. Sexuality, but just not being a slave to what the dominant society of the ruling class says that you should be a slave to. So Tupac's always going to be relevant in that regard. And he's always going to be relevant, too, because, you know, he was a brilliant rapper. People forget that part about Tupac. He was absolutely brilliant. The whole Biggie Tupac thing, you know, there's Biggie, there's Tupac, and then there's everybody else. You know, it's true. Including Jay-Z, I know. Yes, and including the fabulous rappers you have in Atlanta.
Yes.
Love all of you guys, you know, all of you.
Right.
All of you are fabulous.
Oh, stop.
Biggie and Tupac, and then there's everyone else.
And Zenka Burton is with us. She's a hip-hop scholar. I've got to ask you, what's on the essential, if you want to understand Tupac better through his music, give me three or four songs that are essentially Tupac.
The entire album, All Eyes on Me. the entire album.
His biggest seller.
The biggest seller.
Nine million copies or so.
Yes, every song on there. Brenda's Got a Baby, if you really want to know the kind of the different layers of Tupac. I think I Get Around, which is a party song. You know, what people don't understand about hip hop is that you don't have to live in different camps. Like in our minds, outsiders, we think that you have to be in a different camp. You're conscious rap, you're party rap, you're whatever. But most rappers live in all of those different worlds and their music reflects.
How did it get so out of hand? How did this East Coast, West Coast thing, this Biggie Tupac thing get so out of hand? Now both of them are gone.
Well, the academic in me thinks it was orchestrated by the media companies and the record companies.
Really?
Yes.
Give me a line or two on that. What's your argument there?
I think that media, and I'm a media scholar and a member of the media, right? So I say this
As someone who works within the system.
Yeah, yeah. But I think sometimes you can help or hurt a situation. And I think all of the headlines, when all of the back and forth, and I mean, you know, Tupac has one of the most vicious diss records in history.
Hit him up.
I mean, it's vicious. You know, it's just vicious. And it's probably one of the best diss records out of all diss records. But I think that you can either be helpful or harmful. And I think it did not help to have all of these major, because this is at the height of hip hop magazines, too. It does not help when you have these publications, including Rolling Stone, right? And the other iconic music publications really hyping up and talking about these things and feeding into the East Coast, West Coast, in addition to people who are, you know, young people. Hip hop was a youth music, right? So you have people who are looking for their identities. They're looking for where they belong. And then you have gang culture that's running rampant in the country. Mm. Like it just was not a good look. So I think that that's what happened. It was just a series of horrible incidents that came together at the same time and just led to the demise of two brilliant rappers.
And the significance, good, bad, indifferent, of Death Row Records, Suge Knight.
Yeah, I mean, Dre was on Death Row. You know, I mean, say what you will, but Death Row, I mean, they are definitively one of the most productive, creative, and successful rap music labels, I mean, you could say ever. And the talent that came out of Death Row. And so Suge was a lot of things, but he was also able to recognize talent.
Yeah.
And so,
but that record label was tied to kind of a gang culture, correct?
Yeah, but that's not the first time. That's not just hip hop.
That, exactly.
The music industry is tied to crime.
But Tupac wasn't about gang life, was he? His life wasn't about the gangs.
Well, that's what that leads me back to what I started with when I said he was performing, right? Just like we have this political theater that we're watching in Congress now. Same idea. I felt like Tupac was performing.
He assumed an identity?
He was performing that identity because he had to survive.
That's hip-hop scholar Nisenga Burton discussing the Tupac Shakur Archive at the Atlanta University Center Woodruff Library. A play about Tupac's life is running in Atlanta's True Colors Theater Company. We've got the details at gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We talked earlier about the growing Latino population in the South. How diverse is your community? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Facebook and on Twitter. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headley. Have a great day.